Magda looked at her watch. I'm putting it at 7:46. What do you have?
Susan blinked once, then consulted her own watch.
I have 7:44.
I think we can call it 7:45.
Magda turned Eric over just enough to look at the underside of his body. Shock spread across her face.
Susan, you need to come here.
Susan walked the few steps to what she already thought of as the body. The sight she saw then would never leave her.
There are stab wounds, Magda said in a low voice. And his head. Jesus, Susan.
Susan raised the walkie to her mouth, which had gone dry.
Lake House, she said. Pick up.
Lake House, said a sleepy voice.
Sean Greenvale. He was always reliable, and the lake house was one of the only other buildings with its own phone.
I need you to call the police. Tell them to come right into the camp, to the path that leads to the theater. Say there's been a serious accident. No ambulance.
What's going on?
Just do it, Sean.
Behind them, campers were starting to congregate. They were getting louder, talking, crying, pointing. They didn't know exactly what was going on, but it was clear to them, as it had been clear to Susan, that something terrible had happened.
Everyone, she said, stay calm and back up.
Everyone did not keep calm. She needed to establish order now. She did what came most naturally to her. She blew the whistle that hung around her neck. This startled everyone enough to shock them into silence.
Get to the dining pavilion, she said. Now.
She marched over to Brandy and helped her to her feet.
Come on, she said.
Come on, time to go.
Brandy let herself be led, but she was almost dead weight, stumbling through her shock. Patty Horn, who had been staying in the nurse's cabin the last few nights as part of a house arrest, came running, breaking through the wall of campers who were reluctantly leaving the scene.
Is that Eric? She said. Patty, go get your campers and go to the dining pavilion. What about the others? Patty asked. Are they okay?
Susan froze.
Others?
She repeated.
3.
Trains run through countless murder mystery novels. People are pushed off them or vanish when they move between the cars. When trains pass through tunnels, at least one passenger will get an axe in the face in the dark. People who seem to be asleep on trains are dead, victims of strange poisons in their tea. If you're not murdered on a train, you'll probably end up as a witness, seeing something out the window as you speed by. A man with a gun creeping toward a house, a strangling in a window. Train times always mattered. Jasper couldn't have been on the 7:14 from London because it doesn't run on Sundays. Stevie had never actually taken a train anywhere. Her family went places by car only, as trains had a vaguely European and suspicious air about them. It turned out that the train was a pretty quiet and kind of boring tube, where you mostly heard other people's phone conversations or smelled their sandwiches. It had been a few frantic days. Once she got permission to go to Sunny Pines, she had to scramble to gather up her friends, while Carson moved some things around and got them all jobs that suited their abilities. At Ellingham, Stevie had lived in a small house called Minerva, with 3 students on the first floor and 3 on the second. By the end of the school year, this number was down to 4, for various unfortunate reasons. Stevie was one of the 4, as was David. The other 2 were Janelle Franklin, her next-door neighbor, and Nate Fisher, who lived upstairs. She began with Nate. Nate Fisher had written a book when he was 14, a fantasy novel that had gotten so popular online that a publishing company picked it up. The thing he created to keep himself away from people accidentally launched him into the world at large. The publisher wanted him to go on tour, to make videos, to smile and promote and, most important, to write a second book. Nate was always working on his book, which meant that Nate was never working on his book. He went all the way to Ellingham not to write his book. Nate would go to Mars if it meant that he didn't have to write his book. It was never clear to Stevie why he didn't want to write it.
He must have liked writing in order to write a book in the first place. Sometimes she would try to get him to explain, but it always ended with him saying something like, "That's not how it works," before windmilling his arms around and disappearing to his room. She sensed it was something to do with performance anxiety, which she understood. Or maybe it was as simple as not wanting to do something that other people wanted you to do, which was also something she understood. Nate was the only person in the group who would hate the idea of camping more than Stevie, but she was sure that when offered the chance to reunite with his friends, and not write, he would leap at the chance. She was right. Carson had found the perfect job for him. There was some kind of treehouse library at the camp that wasn't used very often. Nate could be the camp librarian, which wasn't really a position. He even arranged to quickly build a bunk space up there out of plywood, so that Nate could stay up there all he wanted.
"I get to live by myself in a tree, doing some bullshit job for no one," Nate said when Stevie told him. "This is my dream, Stevie. This is my dream."
So Nate was in. Next was Janelle. Janelle was the person Stevie considered to be her best friend. She was the person Stevie could go to in the middle of the night when she had a panic attack. She was the person who pushed Stevie to acknowledge her feelings. She had met her partner, Vi, on the first day of school, and the two had been together since. Janelle was a budding engineer, a maker, a crafter, someone who was only happy when she had wires in one hand and a hot glue gun in the other. Whether you needed to build a miniature drone or make a dress, Janelle was your woman. Unlike Nate and Stevie, Janelle was fine with the idea of camp, but wouldn't be content with a pointless job with no responsibilities. Carson shuffled some things around and returned with the perfect gig. Janelle could be head of arts and crafts. "It's going to be a lot of crafting," Stevie explained to her, "and there will be so many supplies to organize." This gave Stevie her cover job. She would be Janelle's assistant. The two of them would share a bunk behind the art pavilion that usually went to senior staff. Not everyone could make it. Vi, Janelle's partner, had gone to Vietnam for the summer to visit family. This was part of the reason Stevie thought Janelle would come. She was lonely without Vi, without her friends. This left David. That conversation had not gone how Stevie had expected. Stevie thought he would accept. His campaign position, while not voluntary, was low paid. It was the kind of job that needed you more than you needed it, and it was clear that he and Stevie missed one another.
"I want to," he said.
Stevie felt her chest rising, but there was a weight hanging off the end of the sentence. But
this work I'm doing now, it means something to me. I didn't apply to college yet. I've committed to this, and I..."
A strange constellation of emotions came upon her. There was a damp rush of sadness, then an urgency of feeling, something like panic, but with a duller edge, then a punch of soft-boiled anger. Back to sadness again, with a goose egg blooming in her throat. All of this happened in about 5 seconds.
"You there?"
he asked. She coughed softly.
"Yep.
Yeah, no, I get it."
"I mean it,"
he said.
"I really want to come be with you. It feels like I'm repairing some of the damage my family has caused by doing this work. I really hate saying no. It sucks saying no."
Even though the answer still felt like a blow, there was a lot of feeling in his voice. She could tell he meant it. She picked at a small hole in her t-shirt.
"Sure," she said. "You have to do this."
It came out a bit dry because Stevie didn't really know how to have sensitive conversations.
"Don't sound so sad,"
he said sarcastically.
"No, I do. I get it."
They hung on a moment in silence.
"But,"
he said,
"I can take a little time off to visit. I'll be there. We'll camp. Oh, we'll camp."
And so, Stevie found herself on a train heading toward the Berkshire Mountains of Massachusetts. Camp Wonder Falls, or Sunny Pines, was located about an hour outside Springfield, not far from Amherst, in the green and rolling landscape dotted with lakes.
The camp had provided an exacting list of things to bring. A set of twin sheets, a pillow, a blanket, 3 towels, all with your name on them. Flip-flops, sneakers, sturdy socks that were at least as high as the ankle, either a one-piece bathing suit or trunks and a swim top, bug spray, bite cream, a high-powered flashlight, at least 1 pair of long sweatpants or similar exercise pants, a long-sleeved sports top, a hat. Ellingham had also set a list of things to bring to school, but the specificity of this one spoke volumes. The sturdy socks at least as high as the ankle meant there was some kind of hiking in the future. The sweatpants and long-sleeved shirt had an ominous ring to Stevie, hinting at activities in wild places where protection would be needed, or maybe walks at night to go raccoon poking. She reminded herself that she was not required to poke raccoons. While she was technically going to be a camp employee, Carson had promised that her position was special. She would have the camp experience without the camp requirements. In the rush to get ready to go, she had little time to learn about the box in the woods case. She knew the basics, of course. All true crime fans did. But she didn't know the case in the way she had known the Ellingham affair. She'd spent over a year researching that case before she wound up at Ellingham. She watched everything, read everything, participated in every message board, listened to every podcast, so that by the time she arrived at the scene, she could navigate without a map and quote half the books. Not so this time. She powered through podcasts as she packed and read as much as she could at night. Her old friend anxiety started bubbling inside her, ready to party. This time, it was too much too soon. She was going to fail, and that would mean she was a failure. She would never solve anything else, never be a detective. Her life would go nowhere. The texts from Nate came at a good moment.
Stevie. Stevie. There is a trapeze in here.
This confused her enough to diffuse her internal situation. When she reached Springfield, she had been lurking in the metallic vestibule of the train for 2 stops, paranoid she would miss it. She dragged her heavy, wheeled suitcase into the terminal. Another text, this time from Carson, who had arranged to meet her.
Outside.
She stepped outside and saw a man, not much taller than her, leaning against the wall, typing furiously on his phone. He clearly worked out a lot. He had muscular arms and a six-pack that he showed off in a snug black t-shirt. The bottom half of his body was adorned in flowing yoga pants in a purple and green mandala pattern. His head was shaved completely bald. He had the word carbon tattooed in huge letters down his left arm and the word based down the right.
Hey,
he said, waving to her as if they were old friends.
Stevie, Stevie!
As she got closer, she noticed that he reeked of burned sage. Not yoga studio levels, more like he'd been in a brush fire on a sage farm.
My car's out this way,
he said. Stevie continued behind, dragging the bag toward the green Tesla that he was opening. The inside of the car was a creamy, pale tan leather that was probably called latte, or toasted coconut, or something like that. A set of wooden meditation beads hung from the rearview mirror, and there was a pink crystal in the cup holder. The sage smell was much stronger inside the car, and Stevie found herself hungry for air.
Barlow Corners is about an hour's drive,
he said, pulling the eerily silent car out of the parking space.
Your friends are already here.
They said there's a trapeze?
Oh, yeah, they're in the bounce house.
Stevie could not bring herself to ask why it was called the bounce house, and it didn't matter. She knew he was about to tell her.
I call it the bounce house because that's where I host all kinds of creators and we bounce ideas around. We call them think jams.
She resisted the impulse to open the car door and jump.
Tonight, you'll all stay in the guest rooms there,
he went on.
Tomorrow, I can drive you through town and take you over to the camp. Might as well get in one night with air conditioning and hot water, right? Also, no snakes.
Anxiety is very accommodating. Minutes ago, Stevie's anxiety was all about failure. It neatly converted itself into worry about places called bounce houses and not having hot water or air conditioning.
It was perfectly ready to bring the snakes to the party. It's a big tent. All problems are welcome.
Snakes? I mean, there are some around the lake, but not at the camp.
The camp is on a lake.
Yeah, but the snakes are. I mean, they're around, but over on the other side. No snakes at the camp.
There were for sure snakes at the camp. It was entirely made of snakes. Why hadn't she thought of the snakes?
Tonight I thought we could have a meeting,
Carson said,
to go over the details of the case, and tomorrow I have something really special planned.
The snake slithered to the side of her thoughts.
What? A big event, sponsored by BoxBox. See, I donated a children's reading room to the town library, so I'm having a big picnic to open it, with free food and entertainment. I've made sure lots of people will be there, including some who were there in 1978. You'll be able to meet some of the witnesses and even some of the suspects. We'll start our work off right. The box in the woods, finally solved.
If it can be solved, Stevie said.
Of course it can. With everything available now, someone just has to put some pressure on, get things moving, look into all the stuff that's been ignored for decades.
But people have been doing that.
Not people who own the camp,
he said with a smile. She had to admit he had a point. A ridge of gently rolling green hills appeared in the distance. Buildings became more scarce, and the land opened up like a blank page waiting for a story. He turned a corner between two sprawling fields. Every road got smaller and deeper into the trees. It reminded her a little of the drive to Ellingham Academy, except that drive was up, up, up. This drive was more gentle, the terrain far less imposing. Everything had the soft veneer of Americana, flags, farm stands, screened porches. There were thick green canopies of trees along the roads, under which people walked dogs or rode bikes, or took purposeful runs while listening to headphones and squinting at an invisible finish line. The first sign they had entered Carson Land was the stone Buddha next to the green mandala-covered mailbox. They turned up a short drive, past a trampoline, a pool, and a small field with three goats. Stevie stepped out into a peaceful place bordered by a burbling creek nestled in the trees. There were piles of rocks out in the shallow water, delicately balanced on one another.
This is the bounce house,
he said, pulling her bag toward a barn, or what had probably been an old barn at some point. Everything about it looked fresh and new, from the electric blue paint to the massive windows with the hot dog mustard yellow sills.
That's my house over there,
Carson said, pointing through the trees to a large purple house with an eye painted where the front of the house met the peak of the roof. It gazed down on Stevie sleepily. The door to the barn opened. There was a high-pitched noise, and then Janelle Franklin came soaring over as if on winged feet and grabbed Stevie in an embrace.
You're wearing your lemons, Stevie said.
Of course! We're all here, almost all here. Janelle loved lemons, and when she wore her lemon print dress, it was a sign that she was happy. She had wrapped her braided hair in a matching yellow scarf and complemented the whole look with a sunny yellow eyeshadow that popped cheerily against her black skin. This is what Janelle was like, always dressed to express. She understood how things went together, how makeup was applied, how to be perfectly together and make it all look easy. It probably was for her. She did calculus in her head for fun. Behind her was Nate, his lips twisted into a wry smile. Even when he smiled, Nate's expression suggested that of an old-timey fisherman resignedly watching his boat being devoured by a sea serpent. His hair was always a bit scruffy, and his clothes a little too big for him. At school, he usually wore beat-up cargo pants or corduroys. For his summer look, he had exchanged these for beat-up cargo shorts. He wore the same t-shirts that he had in school. This one read, "Shrimp Optional."
I'll let you guys catch up, Carson said. I have evening meditation. I'll be back in an hour. Everyone good with vegan pizza?
There was a polite pause.
Or I can get some dairy pizza. See you in a few. Make yourself at home, Stevie. Oh,
Nate said in a low voice, opening the wide barn door.
Wait until you see home.
The first thing that struck Stevie was the vibrant orange color of the walls. It made her eyeballs wobble in her skull.
Restful, isn't it?
Nate said. There were no chairs or tables. Everywhere you looked, there were fancy beanbags made of some NASA-quality foam that made you feel like you were floating and supported you in any position. Thick ropes hung from the ceiling with knots tied in them so you could climb or swing. There were yoga balls and regular inflatable balls and a partially deflated human hamster ball in the corner. Welcome to the house that boxes built, I guess, Janelle said. As reported, there was indeed a single trapeze suspended high up in the rafters.
How do they trapeze in here? Stevie said. There's not enough room to swing, at least not very far.
And what if they fall? We've been wondering about that for the last few hours, Janelle replied. We think they use a hook to pull the trapeze over to the loft. Then they must jump off really gently and kind of hang there. They probably use that to get down.
She indicated a large rolled-up tarp against the wall.
So they just hang from the ceiling and fall into a tarp? Stevie asked.
Yeah. It's not really a trapeze as much as it's a dangler?
He calls them think jams, Nate said, allowing himself to sink deeper into the beanbag.
Did he tell you that?
Think jams.
I mean, the thing is, I don't hate it, Janelle said. And that fact makes me hate myself.
Along the side of the main room, there were hundreds of inch-square pieces of fabric, little flaps of them in a grid pattern, attached to the wall with tape. It wasn't art, Stevie was pretty sure.
We have no idea what those are for, Janelle said. Maybe he's really into quilting.
Stevie flopped into one of the massive beanbags, which caught her in its space beads or foam or whatever was in it. Funny how the world shifts when you're in the same space with your friends. The air is energized. The light is warmer. The 2 weeks they had been separated evaporated, and they began to talk as if they had finished their last in-person conversation moments before.
I'm so ready for this, Nate said. I love summer camp horror movies, so I rewatched a bunch of them last week to prepare. Do you want to hear about summer camp horror movies?
Nate, Janelle began.
You cannot deny me this, Nate said. This is a murder story at a camp. It's how I want to go. My favorite is called Sleepaway Camp. It makes the least sense. First of all, the campers in this movie are like 18 years old. Not the counselors, the campers. Everyone in this movie is terrible. They spend pretty much all their time trying to have the sex. Obviously, though, in terms of the killer, Jason is still the best. He lives in a lake and commits murders in space.
Are you done? Janelle asked.
Do you live in a lake?
Okay, Janelle said, getting up and smoothing out her dress. I have to call Vi. I won't be long. We have to schedule because of the time difference. How's Vi? Stevie asked. They're good. They like Da Nang. It's a lot of family stuff. They're mostly working on their Vietnamese, plus learning more Mandarin. It's, you know, really far, though. I'll be right back in, okay? Right back.
Do you have to make a romance call?
Nate said when Janelle was gone.
No,
Stevie replied.
We don't have a schedule.
How is David?
Good,
she replied with a shrug. One of the things that made Nate and Stevie such good friends was their mutual hatred of sharing emotional things. Somehow, they managed to have a deeper bond by staying on the surface, as if they were snorkeling their feelings, floating along side by side, observing all of nature's wonders without getting close enough to be stung by something under a rock.
So here we are again in Murder Town,
Nate said.
Where you live?
They both gazed up at the trapeze suspended from the ceiling. It was an innocent enough object, meant to be fun, but in that moment it reminded Stevie of another nutshell study, one called Attic, which featured a hanging.
What do you think?
He asked. He didn't need to explain. Stevie knew what he meant, because he meant a lot of things. How was it to be back on a case? What did she think about this case?
I don't know yet, she replied.
I think it's going to be great,
he said.
Murder camp, living in a tree, not seeing anyone. This is my summer. This is when I shine. I'm going to achieve peak me. And there are no tunnels here, so you probably won't get trapped underground. I feel good about it, I think.
That Nate was feeling so positive should have served as a warning. But people rarely recognize signs when they appear.
July 7th, 1978, 8:05 a.m. Sheriff Elliot Reynolds and his deputy, Don McGurk, turned down the drive into Camp Wonder Falls. Don tapped absently on the passenger's side window.
What do you think it is?
Don asked.
Drowning? I hope not,
Sheriff Reynolds replied.
Can't be someone dead, 8 in the morning at the camp?
It didn't make sense to Sheriff Reynolds either. From the sound of the confused message he had gotten over the radio, something very bad had gone down. A serious accident. No ambulance needed. But, as Don pointed out, it seemed unlikely that there was a dead person at the camp on a sunny weekday morning. Then again, since Michael Penhale, Sheriff Reynolds had felt something turn in Barlow Corners. Of course, accidents happened everywhere. But that business, it had tainted things, tainted his reputation. A barely perceptible but inescapable whiff of rot had taken over this once pristine little corner of America. Damn that business. Damn it to hell. Everything about it was terrible. But what was the point of ruining a young man's life like that? Who would it have helped? No. He really did not want another dead kid in Barlow Corners. Susan Marks was waiting for them by the camp entrance, along with a weeping Patty Horn. The look on her face confirmed the worst. When he stopped the car, Susan immediately opened the back door and shooed Patty inside, then followed.
What's going on, Sue?
The sheriff asked.
One of the counselors is dead. Eric Wilde. He's been murdered.
Come on,
Don said.
I've just about been able to keep this place under control. He's up on the path toward the woods. Keep going and this road will join up with it. Hurry.
Sheriff Reynolds didn't have to be told twice. He started up the road with as much speed as he could manage without risking hitting a wayward camper.
There's more, Susan said. We have 3 more missing. Apparently they went out into the woods last night.
Who's missing?
He said, glancing at her in the rearview mirror.
Diane McClure, Todd Cooper, and Sabrina Abbott.
Sabrina Abbott? And Todd Cooper? Shit,
Don said quietly. The sheriff shot him a glance.
Patty, Susan said, explain to them what you told me.
Patty burst into a torrent of sobs.
Come on, Patty, Susan said firmly but not unkindly. We can't waste any time. Tell them.
Patty heaved, then brought herself under enough control to speak.
They went out around 11. They go out. Eric gets the...
Gets the what?
The sheriff prompted as he turned the car slightly to merge onto the dirt path.
I can't.
You can,
he said.
I don't care what was going on. Just tell me.
He gets the grass in the woods. They went out for the grass.
Shit,
Don said again, but he managed to keep it under his breath.
Stop here,
Susan said. Don remained in the car to coordinate over the radio and watch Patty. Susan and the sheriff hurried down the path. The morning was eerily silent. The campers all gathered in the dining area. It was a stunning morning, soft and sweet, birdsong in the air. It made the sight of Eric's discolored and lifeless body all the more grotesque. Magda McMurphy, the camp nurse, was with him, though it was immediately clear that there was nothing she could do aside from shoo away the flies.
He's been dead for some time, Magda said. A few hours at least.
The sheriff squatted down next to the body.
Let's turn him over,
he said to Magda. They rolled the body carefully, and the full extent of the carnage was now clear.
What in holy hell happened here?
The sheriff said in a low voice. I can count 6 stab wounds, Magda said. There may be more, it's hard to tell. He's also got a massive head wound.
Sheriff Reynolds took a long, steadying breath and sprung back to stand.
Come on,
he said to Susan, then broke into a run back to the car. Susan paced him easily. He threw open the back door to the cruiser, where Patty Horn sat with her knees tucked up to her chest. Her long hair pulled over the sides of her face like she was trying to cocoon herself away from the horror.
Patty,
he said without any preamble.
Where do they go to get the grass?
In the woods, up the road.
You've been there?
Once.
She nodded heavily.
I don't know where, it's just in the woods somewhere.
Do you walk or drive?
Todd drives, we take his Jeep.
About how far up the road? How long do you drive?
I don't know,
she said, still weeping but maintaining control.
5 minutes?
Stay here with Susan.
Patty slid out of the car, looking terrified.
Keep all the kids together,
he said to Susan.
I don't even want them going to the bathroom by themselves, got it?
Susan nodded, and he knew she was more than up to the task. He got back behind the wheel, where Don regarded him in bafflement.
What's going on? We've got a dead kid with 6 stab wounds to his chest. Shit, he said. Do we call the mayor if Todd's involved? No,
the sheriff said, stepping on the gas.
We're not getting him involved again. Keep him the hell out of this as long as we can. We call the state police and head out now, see if we can find the others. Get them on the horn.
They took the bumpy road through the woods at a good pace. It didn't take long to find Todd's Jeep. Patty's estimate had been correct. It was about 5 minutes up the road, parked off to the side on a slight diagonal. The sheriff pulled the cruiser up behind it. He retrieved his gun and holster from the locked glove compartment. Guns weren't usually required in Barlow Corners. He'd only pulled it once in his career there, during a suspected robbery that turned out to be a raccoon in the wall.
Get the rifle from the trunk,
he said to Don. Once armed, the two men began to scan the area. There was nothing around to suggest a rendezvous spot.
Todd?
The sheriff called.
Diane! Sabrina!
There was no reply.
Footprints this way, Don said as he scanned the dirt. Looks like they went in this direction.
They tramped into the trees, pushing back branches, calling all the while. Birds scattered, but no one replied. They came upon a small clearing with a blanket on the ground and the smoldering remains of a fire, now just a tiny smoking glow under a pile of smoked out logs. There was a tape player sitting on one of the logs by the fire. The blanket was a sleeping bag that had been unzipped and spread out, and an open can of Coke sat on a log. 3 unopened beers were on the ground nearby, along with a cafeteria tray that contained a McDonald's bag, some small papers, and some kind of green substance.
Marijuana,
the sheriff said, examining it.
They were here. I don't know why they'd leave this behind if they weren't in trouble.
He scanned the ring of trees around them. In a clearing like this, you were vulnerable. There were ample places to hide, and someone could approach from any direction. In the dark, this place would have been terrifyingly easy to attack a group of teenagers. He pulled his handgun from its holster.
Todd Cooper is a big kid,
Don said, as if having the same thought.
He'd fight. So would Diane.
But there was no sign of a fight. The area was neat. It was as if they had simply walked away from their camp, leaving the fire, the tape player, and a significant amount of grass spread out on a tray. The sheriff and Don made a slow circuit of the area, looking at the spaces between the trees, examining the ground.
Here,
the sheriff said.
Something's been dragged here.
They picked their way between the trees. Don reached for a branch with a piece of torn dark green fabric and a tuft of white filler clinging to it.
Looks like it could have come from a sleeping bag,
Don said. They continued on, and about a minute later came upon a sagging hunting blind. Beside it, neatly rolled, was the sleeping bag with a tear in the side. The woods were velvety quiet as they approached the box. The sheriff opened it slowly.
The smell hit first, seconds before his brain could process the hideous jigsaw that was before his eyes.
Oh, God,
Don said.
What the hell? What?
There was a single word message, roughly painted on the inside of the lid in white paint. It read, "Surprise." 4. It appeared that Carson had correctly read the room when he returned with a stack of pizza boxes containing every possible kind of cheesy, meaty pizza. The traveling, the reunion joy, and the sweet woodland air seemed to have stimulated all their appetites, and the pies were soon torn apart and consumed. For his own meal, Carson brought a giant cup of thick blue juice and regarded the pizza carnage like someone watching a nature documentary.
So you own a box service, right?
Nate asked innocently as he reached for his fifth slice of pizza.
One of those get a box every month things? Box box,
Carson said. Nate knew all this already, which meant he was asking for entertainment rather than information.
What is it, though? Every month you get a curated selection of boxes,
Carson replied.
What's in the boxes?
Boxes. It's a box full of boxes. We have themes like bathroom boxes or closet boxes or gift boxes, kitchen boxes, garden boxes. Everyone needs boxes. We're starting a new thing in a few months. We're either going to call it bag box or bag bag. You get reusable bags. See all those fabric samples over there? Those are for the bags. I was think jamming them.
Why?
Nate said.
Why what?
Why would you want a bag full of bags or a box full of boxes?
It's environmentally friendly, Carson replied.
How?
Because you get the boxes, so you don't have to buy them. Same as the bags.
Isn't it worse to send people a bunch of boxes they don't need and then have them get rid of some of them? Especially when you add all the packaging and the transport and everything?
It's about convenience as well, Carson said.
How is it convenient to get a bunch of boxes or bags?
People like it,
Carson said, though more quietly.
We have over 400,000 subscribers. Anyway, we should get started.
Nate happily chomped off half a slice of pizza in one bite as Carson gestured them over to the beanbags and sofas in the center of the room. Stevie, Janelle, and Nate moved over, Nate taking a pizza box with him. Carson picked up a remote control. The lights dimmed gently, and there was a soft whirring noise as a massive screen unfurled from the ceiling. A title slide appeared on the screen.
The Box in the Woods Murders, July 6th through 7th, 1978. It's important to set a sense of this town, this camp, at this time, because these murders are very much of a time and a place.
Stevie could tell at once that Carson had written this line in advance and was proud of it. He was testing out his podcast script, for sure.
The 1970s were a different era. For example, information and communication were more limited.
Well, yeah, Nate said. That's why their slasher films work. No one knows anything and no one can call for help.
Right, Carson said. And the lack of communication impacted safety. This is a time when everything was loose. Your comings and goings couldn't be tracked. Everything relied more on word of mouth and who knew what. The world was smaller. The camp was an extension of the high school and the town. A closed loop. Everyone knew everyone. Which brings us to
Barlow Corners. This slide featured a photo that Stevie had seen several times now. It was the image that pretty much every book or article or documentary on the case included. It was a color photo with a sepia tint, the colors washed out and overly bright at the same time. A group of people stood in front of an equestrian statue, decked out in red, white, and blue bunting. Most of the people in the group were middle-aged. The men all wore Bermuda shorts with belts. The women wore dresses or pants that they would have referred to as slacks.
So this, Carson said, was a picture taken at the Bicentennial in 1976, 2 years before the murders.
The town built and dedicated a statue to the town founder, John Barlow, a minor Revolutionary War hero. A local photographer took the picture and submitted it to Life magazine, and it ran in a special commemorative edition. There are a few people in this photo associated with the case. It says a lot about the town. A small place, all American, everyone knows everyone. And pretty much everyone was connected in some way to the victims.
We'll start with the basics, Carson said. The four victims. All recent graduates of Liberty High. All residents of Barlow Corners. All four worked at the camp. This is Eric Wilde.
He brought up a picture of a boy with wildly curly, light-colored hair and a goofy grin.
18 years old, son of the town librarian and a teacher at Liberty. Generally well-liked, but could get into trouble.
Diane McClure,
a tough-looking, red-headed girl with a thin smile and a freckled face, appeared on the screen.
Daughter of the owners of the town diner, the Dairy Duchess. Academically unremarkable. Liked rock music and having fun. Your basic 70s teenager. She was girlfriend to this guy, Todd Cooper.
Fashions come and go, but jawlines are eternal. Todd Cooper had a good one, if a big one. His face was almost square. He had medium-length hair in a 70s-style feathered cut. There was a thin, wry smile on his lips. His face exuded confidence. Arrogance, even.
Son of the mayor, football captain, and a lot of trouble. More on him later. The real outlier of the group was...
A photo of a girl came up. It was hard to say what made her seem different from the rest. The photo was the same quality, and her raven hair was in long 70s-style wings. She had big brown eyes and a sincere smile. There was something about her, something in the way she looked at the camera. There was a bright spark there, something that connected to Stevie viscerally.
Sabrina Abbott, the town good girl, daughter of a dentist, top student at Liberty High. Volunteered at the library every week, reading to little kids. It's one of the enduring mysteries that surrounds this case. Why did the town good girl go with three of the bad seeds to a drug buy in the woods? But let's get to it.
The murders.
Here are the undisputed facts. On the night of July 6th, Sabrina, Eric, Todd, and Diane left the camp somewhere around 11 at night in Todd's Jeep. They went to the woods to pick up the weekly pot delivery. Eric Wilde was the dealer at camp. Todd and Diane were a couple, and Sabrina Abbott was along for the ride for whatever reason. The next morning, one of the campers found Eric Wilde face down on a dirt path through the woods that led to the theater and archery range. He had been struck on the head and stabbed 6 times. 5 of the wounds were fatal.
He brought up a black and white photo of the scene, taken from a short distance. There was a sheet over the body on the dirt path, and a group of police officers standing around it, conferring with one another.
The camp quickly figured out that the other three were missing, so the police rode out to try to find them. The Jeep was parked alongside the road. They found the campsite.
He brought up a picture of the campsite, a smoldering fire, a blanket, a camping lantern, a plastic tray with something all over it, some sodas, a backpack.
No sign of a struggle,
Carson said.
It looks like they simply left the site. The police searched the area and found an old hunting blind. When they opened it up, well, that was the box in the woods. Pictures of the bodies aren't available to the public, just a description. Here's a diagram.
A creepy drawing of three featureless bodies in a rectangle, with dots and dashes to mark wounds and bindings. Stevie had seen these kinds of drawings before, but they always unnerved her.
The bodies were arranged in the box neatly. Diane and Sabrina were facing one way, and Todd was turned the other, his head between the girl's feet. Todd and Diane both had massive head wounds, like Eric. Then they were each stabbed multiple times. Todd had 16 stab wounds, and Diane had 9. Sabrina was the only one without a head wound. She was stabbed 21 times and had defensive marks on her hands, so she was probably facing her killer. The evidence suggested they were killed at the campsite and then moved to the box.
The killer bound their legs and wrists in red nylon cord. There was a single word written in white paint on the inside of the box's lid.
He pulled up the most famous photo from the case, one of the only crime scene photos that had been made available to the public. The word "surprise," painted in rough, blocky letters. It was so comically ghoulish, it seemed like it couldn't be real.
There are three major theories about who did it, Carson said. Let's do the least likely first.
Drug deal.
The police first suspected that it was a drug deal gone wrong. Eric Wilde was the camp pot dealer, and the four of them were out in the woods that night picking up the weekly supply for the camp. So people thought, illegal activity in the woods must have something to do with it. Also, Eric was found in a different location than the others. Sabrina, Todd, and Diane were in the box. Eric was almost at the camp.
But this one is dumb, Stevie said. They found all the pot at the crime scene, so the sale had gone through. There's no reason for anyone to get killed over a little bit of pot that no one even bothered to take.
Agree,
Carson said.
Basically, no one really thinks this had anything to do with it, but it was an easy explanation, especially then. Pot in the woods ending in multiple murders? Sure, why not? Now, the next one is more compelling and was the most popular theory for a long time.
The Woodsman.
So the 1970s were kind of the golden age of serial killers. There were loads of them. There was one known to operate in the area at the time called the Woodsman. The first murder was in 1973 in New Hampshire. Then there were two in Massachusetts, one each in 1974 and 1976, and two in upstate New York in 1975. There were two more cases in 1979 and 1980, both back in New Hampshire. The Woodsman stabbed his victims and left them in the woods, covered in sticks and debris, with their hands and feet bound in red cording. In all the cases, the word "surprise" was written somewhere near the scene, usually on a tree. So it looks like the Woodsman, right? Now, here's the thing. The Woodsman's crimes were in the news. The local paper even covered the story in 1976.
Carson brought up a photocopy of an old newspaper article entitled, "Woodland Killer Strikes Near Hawley."
This murder happened about a 45-minute drive from here, so it was local enough. It's a real 70s kind of story. A 19-year-old girl named Becky O'Keefe was a free spirit who was spending the summer camping in the Berkshires. Her friends last saw her when she left to hitchhike to get to another campsite to meet a guy. She was found 2 days later. This newspaper article says that her legs and wrists were bound in red cord, and that the word "surprise" was written on a tree. This is pretty much exactly how the bodies in the box in the woods were found. But the police kept some details out of the press. In all the Woodsman killings, the bodies were bound with torn pieces of silky red fabric ripped into pieces, and all the messages were written in chalk. So it seemed obvious from the start that someone was copying the details in the paper. This killer used white paint and red nylon cord.
So it was a copycat, Stevie said. Did they find out anything about the paint or the cord?
The white paint was found to be a common type that you could buy at almost any hardware store in the northeastern United States. The cord was a little more interesting.
A close-up photograph of a piece of red cord on a white background came up on the screen. There was a ruler under the cord, showing that this section was 6 inches long.
This particular cord was sold in sporting goods stores, and it was commonly used in water-related sports in the area. Fishermen used it to secure boats and supplies. The camp used it to tie up canoes. The police tried to run down all recent purchases of the cord, but the best guess is that someone probably lifted it from a boat or a supply shed. It would have been easy enough to get.
Can't they test for DNA? Janelle said.
Here's where things in this case get ridiculous. The police got rid of most of the clothing the victims were wearing.
What?
Nate said.
It's amazing, but it's true. They still have Eric's t-shirt, but all the rest? Someone just got rid of them. They tested the shirt and came up with a profile, but it didn't match the Woodsman samples. Could have been the killer's, could have been anyone's. There was nothing usable on the cord.
Didn't they test the town or anything?
Nate asked. Don't they do that, take samples from everyone? What they found wasn't good enough to test everyone against. And now we come to the third.
Revenge.
Revenge, Nate read in a low voice. Revenge.
He brought up a photo of a smiling young boy.
The previous December,
Carson said,
in 1977, an 11-year-old named Michael Penhill was struck and killed by a car. No one was ever arrested or charged. It was written off as a hit and run. But it seemed to be common knowledge in town that Michael was run over by Todd Cooper. His brother, Paul, was friends with the victims and worked at the camp. The neighbors said that the Penhale family was home on the night of the murders, and Paul Penhale had someone who could place him at the camp that night. That person was Sean Greenvale, Sabrina Abbott's ex-boyfriend. Sabrina had broken up with him a few weeks before. Some people speculated that either Paul or Sean might have wanted to kill Todd or Sabrina, respectively, but they were also seen by Susan Marks, the head of camp. Also, nothing ties them to the case except for the fact that Todd probably hit Michael Penhale, and Sabrina broke up with Sean. And that is pretty much that. The case was so badly handled from the start that it was dead in the water.
Carson hit the remote again, and the screen glided up to the ceiling, rolling itself snugly back to sleep. The lights came up like a sunrise.
Our goal this summer, he said, is to make some headway into a case that's been dormant for decades. It may seem difficult, but we have a lot going for us. I own the camp, so we can turn it upside down if we want. Lots of people who were alive then are still here in town. We have the internet, and we have Stevie. We have an early start tomorrow. I'll come get you guys at, say, 7?
When Carson left, the three friends sat in their respective beanbags for a moment in silence.
The murder camp thing is a little less fun now,
Nate finally said.
5.
Stevie tried to focus her newly opened eyes on the thing hanging from the ceiling. What the hell was she looking at? Oh, right, the trapeze. Stevie had spent the night in a pile of beanbags on the floor of the main room. There were several guest bedrooms in the bounce house, but she had fallen asleep here while talking to Nate and decided to stay. She would have been content to stay there for a while longer, floating on the foam or beads, drifting in and out of sleep. But Janelle was up and moving, and it sounded like Nate was in the shower. She pushed herself up and began getting ready for the day. Carson appeared several minutes early, not bothering to knock as he came into the barn.
Lots to do today, he said. First, we'll drive through the town so I can show you all around. Then we'll go to the camp, get you settled in, give you the whole tour.
The drive from Carson's compound to the town was a sedate one. Every house had a front porch, often a screened one. Everywhere you looked, there were flags, flower planters, green lawns, and shady spaces. This was the kind of town where everyone seemed to have a tire swing. There was one incredibly sharp turn along a wooded stretch, which then led them past a full-size blue billboard that read, Liberty High, Home of the Mighty Owls.
Take it down a notch, sign, Nate said. Why are you yelling about owls?
The sign was ridiculously huge, almost as high as the trees around it, and it seemed entirely out of place along the road. The high school it announced was a modestly sized red brick building, mid-century and fairly ugly compared to all the other places Stevie had seen along the way. The school and its sign were then left behind for another half mile of woods and streams before they reached a traffic light.
This is Barlow Corners, Carson said, turning onto a slightly busier street. Population 2,000. This is the main drag here, all the businesses.
There were the kinds of places you see in every small town. A boutique full of local crafts, scarves, and bric-a-brac. A savings and loan. A place for takeout tacos. A yoga studio. There was the Dairy Duchess, the diner that had been owned by Diane's family. He indicated a cheerful-looking coffee shop called Sunshine Bakery.
That place over there is where we're going first, he said. It's run by Patty Horn. She was friends with at least 3 of the victims.
The Sunshine Bakery was a painfully adorable, small-town kind of business, painted in a half dozen varieties of yellow, from a pale buttery color to a lemon, all the way to a near orange that mirrored the namesake sun. It had several glass cabinets of genuinely astonishing cakes on display, real works of art, detailed and sculpted. Janelle was drawn to them at once like a moth to a flame. Behind the counter was a woman with dusty blonde hair pulled up in a messy bun. She wore loose, distressed jeans and a blue apron. She looked to be somewhere in her 50s and seemed lost in thought, examining a list.
"Morning," she said, looking a bit surprised. "Camp already? I thought the counselors were coming tomorrow."
"These guys are special," Carson said before anyone else could answer. "This is Stevie Bell. She was the one who solved those murders at Ellingham Academy back in the fall."
"Oh," Patty Horn said.
Stevie could tell she didn't really know the story, but was being polite and acting like she was trying to remember the details.
"Wow, that's impressive. And you're going to be counselors?"
"Yep," Carson said quickly. "Here to grab some coffee and..."
He stared at the display of baked goods under glass as if he were looking at a collection of captive spiders.
"Muffins? Or whatever you want. I don't drink coffee or eat sugar."
Stevie looked around the room at the framed historical photos of Barlow Corners over the years, along with some portraits of an older man. Janelle was closely examining the bakery case, where three small cakes were on display. One was baby blue, with a delicate pattern of raised white edging like Wedgwood china. There was one that was covered in butterflies, and a third that was in the form of an exploding volcano.
"Your cakes are beautiful," Janelle said. "The detail is incredible."
"Thank you," Patty said.
"Those are samples I did for a wedding this week. They came out really well, so I've left them up for display."
"How did you even make those butterflies?"
"They're sugar," Patty said. "Are you interested in decorating cakes? Here, I'll show you up close."
She removed the cakes from the case and set them on the counter.
"For this one here," she said, indicating the blue cake, "it's designed as a replica of a Wedgwood plate the bride's grandmother got for her own wedding."
"How did you get that detail?"
"Well, for that one, I made silicone molds of the actual plate."
Janelle's eyes almost glowed at the words, "silicone molds."
"Oh, no,"
Nate said quietly.
"She's getting a new craft."
There was no denying it. Janelle Franklin had never met a craft that she didn't love.
"With the butterflies, I made them separately," Patty went on. "But you see the vine work here? Actually, I goofed this up a bit and had to fill in a mistake with more leaves. You can cover up a lot of things with icing. Most people work from the middle out when decorating a cake. Set your main element in the middle, then go toward the edges and down the sides. It's true that this helps in terms of not disturbing any edge work by accidentally hitting it as you go. But I've always preferred working from the outside in."
"Like a crime scene," Stevie said. She didn't mean to say it out loud. The words slithered out on their own. Patty looked over the edge of the cake.
"A crime scene?"
"She does this," Nate explained.
Stevie quickly surmised that this was one of those cases where she sounded weird if she explained, but far more weird if she did not.
"What I mean is that crime scenes are processed from the outside in," Stevie said. "First, they set up a wide perimeter, closing off the entire area to make sure the whole scene can be looked at for things like footprints, items, tire tracks, whatever. Then they move closer in toward the body or..."
Patty began turning the cake aimlessly, like you might do if a random teenager popped up in front of you and told you your elaborate cake was like a crime scene.
"She does this," Nate repeated.
"I'm not sure I'm going to look at my cakes in the same way again," Patty replied.
"I think she's going to remember you,"
Nate said as they stepped outside with their coffees and muffins.
"You have a way."
"It just came out," Stevie said. "Those cakes are really impressive," Janelle said, her thoughts still back in the bakery.
"I'd love to make silicone molds. Maybe we can do it in the art pavilion. Maybe we can do a cupcake decorating session. Kids would love that, right?"
She pulled out her phone and started taking notes.
"She's so pure,"
Nate said, watching her and smiling again.
"I'm not sure I like this happy you," Stevie replied.
"Get used to it, or don't. because no one is going to see me once I get in my tree.
On the town green, Carson was speaking to a crew that was unloading long poles from the back of a truck. In their life at Ellingham, Janelle had built a Rube Goldberg machine for a national competition. Stevie had many fond memories of Janelle dragging her poles around the workshop, welding and building and generally being a badass. The machine had come to a bad end, but that was not Janelle's fault.
Are you going to re-enter next year? Stevie asked, gesturing to the poles.
Probably not, Janelle said, understanding at once. I'm looking for a new kind of project. I'm thinking robotics right now, but I have a few weeks to decide.
Carson saw them and waved them over.
Setting up for tonight's event, he said as they approached. To dedicate the Sabrina Abbott Children's Reading Room. Let me show it to you since we're here, Carson said.
He marched them toward the library next to the green. A classical building painted a prim white, with two columns supporting the front portico. The library was small and a bit out of date, but there were several people inside, and the displays looked well curated. Carson walked straight through the building to the more modern structure at the back. Only one person was inside, a woman in a blue wrap dress, sorting and arranging a long shelf of picture books. This could only be Allison Abbott. The resemblance to Sabrina was unmistakable. She had the same big brown eyes, the same determined look. She looked to be in her mid-50s, with short, dark hair graying only at the temples. She looked at the coffees and muffins